Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Wherever you are, this is the Interpreter's Workshop Podcast. I'm Tim Curry, your host. Here we talk everything sign language interpreting. The ins, the outs, the ups, the downs, the sideways of interpreting. If you're a student, a new interpreter, experienced interpreter, this is the place for you. If you want to know more, go to interpretersworkshop.com. Let's start talking interpreting. And now, the quote of the day by Peruvian-born Carlos Castaneda, American anthropologist and writer. The basic difference between an ordinary man and a warrior is that a warrior takes everything as a challenge, while an ordinary man takes everything as a blessing or a curse. As an interpreter, we face many challenges that can be blessings or curses. When we have something that's positive or something that's negative in our work, this quote helps us think of it as a challenge. How can we use this, whether it's positive or negative, to improve ourselves as an interpreter, a colleague, and improve the profession? Today we talk again with Robin Dean. She tells us how her application of demand control schema to our profession took off like wildfire so quickly that not everything was understood correctly, which was a blessing and a curse. She talks about how we as interpreters and expats, those of us living in other countries, have similarities, things that give us positives and negatives and challenge us every day. And she touches on interpreting as a practice profession. Let's get started. I remember the first workshop that I went to, which had this newfangled demand control schema topic, and it was presented by the former director of the program where I learned interpreting, Joni Bice, which was my last guest on the podcast. And she did a great job with the workshop. It was intriguing to me and made clear sense to me. But that was quite a while ago. I guess that was before, according to your timeline, it was right at the time when you were first starting to present it.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means to me is that it took off rather quickly and spread quickly, because I'm talking about Oklahoma. And the only things that usually go fast to Oklahoma are tornadoes. So now I'm going to get some backlash myself from Oklahomans. I'm just kidding. I know the Texans are happy I said that, but no. Okay.
which is a blessing and a curse, right? Like it gave me the encouragement that this is something that has value and is beneficial to people, mm-hmm. because I wouldn't have done it if that component weren't evident. I lose energy quickly for things that are only of interest to me.
Sure.
And so that was the blessing part. But then the curse was that people were saying, well, where are the curricular materials and how do I teach this? And mm-hmm. how do you distinguish between interpersonal and paralinguistic? Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the answers because I hadn't played with the constructs enough myself to have that.
Yeah. It was, you know, your baby being taken and other people were putting their perspectives to it and adding their opinions to it. And you're thinking, but I don't know if that's actually true. And so it was out of your hands, it felt like. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And a perfect example of that takes us back to the liberal to conservative spectrum, where people would say, so what Robin's work says is there's no wrong answers, right? Mm. And that's not what the liberal to conservative spectrum says at all. As a matter of fact, there's these very clear two dotted lines. And on the opposite ends of those, it's saying there are decisions that are wrong because they're too conservative and wrong because they're too liberal. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, that was a sense of, I mean, when you're a person who's concerned about what people will do with your work as an educator, that there's really not much you can do unless you just mm-hmm. keep it all to yourself. And that's not what education is about. So you put stuff out there. And of course, it helped me develop ideas and constructs that eventually I came to publish about because of the fact that I worked with faculty members at universities and working interpreters, et cetera, mm-hmm. over the years with questions and answers and such that actually helped to develop the work. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it got out, obviously, as I was saying, is good for those reasons. But you're right. Things that would come back at me of, oh, yes, you know, you say, mm-hmm. and I don't know where you would have gotten that from. Yeah. So, yeah. And even when it's published, right, like it's yeah. written in black and white, it's still, and that's one of the reasons why we do, and we did publish, we publish something probably every year, mm. oftentimes in response to, let me make sure that this is clear, right?
Right.
To follow up to some of the ways in which it sort of spread like wildfire.
Yeah. Yeah. How did all of this make you turn to, or perhaps what was the decision to study in the UK?
I was lucky in 2001. So the first publication that we had with the first seminal article was in 2001. It was also the same time that we were funded by the Department of Education mm-hmm. to begin to infuse elements of demand control schema into interpreter education programs. And then we were lucky to get another grant in 2005, which allowed us to continue that work. And then I had another grant that allowed me to continue my work all the way up until about 2010. And then with the Republicans in office, there was fewer and fewer Department of Education grants. And I wasn't finding anything that was fitting what I wanted to do with the work. People were willing to say to me, oh, you can work on this grant and I'll put you on for 10%, et cetera. But of course, I was quite happy to go back to interpreting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was still interpreting this whole time as well, sort of in a part-time basis, but I was happy to go back to interpreting and I didn't want to do academic work for academic work's sake. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do my own stuff, just, you know, yeah. perhaps selfishly. So in 2010, early 2011, I was working almost exclusively interpreting and doing some workshops that I was invited to do in the US and abroad. And an email from Graham Turner came through my inbox, of course, just because I was on a list. Mm-hmm. He wasn't sending it directly to me. And I thought, well, here's an opportunity. It was a scholarship to, you know, live and study in at Harriet Watt. And I thought, well, here's an opportunity to get a grant to do research on something I'm interested in, which is all the things I had been doing and wanting to continue to do. Mm-hmm. I didn't want a PhD. I was absolutely not the least bit interested in a PhD. But that was kind of the, you know, the other side of that coin. If I wanted to take advantage of it, was mm-hmm. technically I was supposed to do a PhD at the same time. So I applied for it. And I think it kind of came as a shock to the folks, specifically Graham Turner. I don't know if you have to edit this part out. We might have to check with it. It came as a shock. Like, why would you want to get a PhD at the age of 43, right? At the time I was 43 when I was headed to Scotland. And why do you want to do this? You know, I basically said what I just said now, which is I want to continue to do research. And of course, the idea of living outside of the United States, as I'm sure you can identify, mm-hmm. was just fascinating. And being mm-hmm. a redhead, to live in a place where you are not you're now 11% of the population as opposed to 2% of the population, I was all about that. Yeah. So where it's cold and it rains and there's no sun to burn you, I thought,
yes,
this is a match made in heaven.
Yeah.
So that's how I came to apply and submit a proposal, which had to sort of meet muster with the rigor of a typical grant application, so to speak, mm-hmm. And was accepted in May. And so in September, I basically packed up my entire life and moved to the UK. And it was the best decision.
Yeah. You were not teaching before this.
No. Just as a supervision leader, you know, reflective practice, case conferencing, workshops. Mm-hmm. I, you know, did train the trainer stuff that was coming through the grant, but teaching in the sort of formal sense of that word, I think I maybe taught one or two demand control schema courses at NTID as an mm-hmm. adjunct instructor and also at other the University of Northern Colorado, of course, with the folks there. And so I had done those ad hoc, but no, it wasn't necessarily my aim to be a university professor or instructor.
Yeah.
But that came with the opportunity to teach healthcare interpreting at the graduate level.
Yeah.
It, again, talk about a match made in heaven. That's what I would want to do.
Yeah. So the move to the UK, was it all you expected or was it different somehow?
Yeah. You know, I don't know how you feel. I mean, I was 43, so I want to make sure that folks understand that I wasn't young and therefore not set in my ways. I was the opposite. And so I couldn't have imagined it. There's no way I could have imagined it. Mm-hmm. The main thing that was surprising was I thought, okay, I've got the language and I've got the culture down for the most part. Like it's close enough Western, right?
Yeah.
Culture. I should be able to adapt. Mm-hmm. I did not have any of that down. I was the systems by which things function in the UK, even though we quote unquote share a language, which we don't, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was so tired. Mm-hmm. I was just so tired all the time because I had to constantly try to figure out how this system worked, how that system worked. Mm-hmm. And because of the sort of politeness expectations and indirect way of communicating mm-hmm. of not all but some British folks, I also found myself always having to figure out what people were saying to me. Like I knew I was being told something, right? Usually something that I was doing wrong, but I couldn't figure out what it was. Mm-hmm. So I would say the cognitive work that went along with just every day trying to figure out what was going on around me mm-hmm. is something I take for granted when I'm here in the US, mm-hmm. that I became very aware of my foreignness, my stranger in a strange land mm-hmm. Sense was very palpable. And some people, I think, certainly that was exciting on some level.
Sure.
But again, it goes back to it's just fatiguing. I just kind of felt tired all the time. And I remember I would, instead of calling people up on the phone for information about, you know, hooking up my utilities or booking into an appointment for this, that, or the other thing, I would get on the bus and I would go down to the place so I could see people face to face to have the conversation. Mm-hmm. In part, it was the accent, certainly, but also because people would just say things that I just didn't understand. Mm-hmm. One of the famous lines, I was looking for a flat to live, and it took me a very long time to find something that was suitable. I was told, oh, you know, £650 a month would be enough to get a flat, you know, that would be a decent flat. But again, I'm 43 and I'm not used to living in a hovel, right? I'm not used to living in a small single room. So I was like, okay, no, it's not 650. I've got to keep going up and up to find a place that was livable. Anyway, I found this place. It was fabulous. And I was talking to the person who was showing me the elements of the flat. And he said to me, well, you have to know that this is a conservation area. So there's no bins and there's no double glazing. Now, there's nothing about that sentence that I understood. Nothing about that sentence that I understood. This is a conservation area. And because of that, there are no bins and no double glazing. And I just stood and looked at him and I said, oh, okay. And that was another surprising thing about me, because I'm a person who, if I don't understand something, I'm going to ask for clarification.
Yeah.
In the U.S., in the mm-hmm. US. But when I just got so tired of being bewildered all the time that I just went, okay, I get mm-hmm. it. Now I know what it means, right?
Right.
Their term for conservation, we would say preservation. We want to preserve this building. It's an old building. And so we're preserving it. Therefore, we can't make changes to the windows. So they're not double paned, as we would say in the mm-hmm. US. They're double glazed. And then the bins, of course, refer to the garbage cans that you would wheel out in the United States to the front of the area. So I eventually came to figure out, but that statement has been sort of the defining factor of sort of a metonym, if you will, or a metonym phrase for what my experience was like in the UK. But I met the most wonderful people there, my fellow PhD students who were also immigrants and foreigners who were also getting their PhDs. We were able to commiserate, even though they were coming from very different countries than the US, we were able to commiserate on what it was like to be a stranger in the strange land.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I assume you can identify.
Oh, yes. Every day here, every day. And I don't have the same language. So, yeah.
Yes, that's right.
But you're right. It's cognitively just fatiguing. In the early days, you find yourself looking for that comfort. Mm-hmm. Whether it's watching some TV show from America that you probably wouldn't watch if you were in America, eating, oh my goodness, going to a fast food joint, just having a hamburger, you know, something
predictable.
Yeah, predictable. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was kinder. I was nicer in the UK. Here, I am not a kind and nice person, but you're just constant, and for good reason. I think that was a good judgment on my part, is that I just constantly held back, you know, and contained myself and contained my personality to some degree, depending on, of course, who I was with. Is that almost like a cultural humility I tried to adopt. When I'm here, like you're saying, you know, you sort of perhaps like being in sweatpants, you sort of forget, or you don't notice that you're perhaps, you know, gaining weight because you're like, oh, it's all comfortable here. And you're not on your, you're not crossing your T's and dotting your I's when you're in the United States, but when you're elsewhere, you're mindful and you should be mindful.
Exactly.
But I know that some people, you know, like yourself who ended up staying, you know, sort of expats who leave the US and stay. I didn't think that that was possible for me. I mean, in part because I have, you know, people here in the US who I need to be and want to be close to.
Sure.
But also because it was, I never got over the sense of being a foreigner.
Yeah.
And that sense of mindfulness as well.
And you were also going through a PhD program, which is not, well, you know, too easy.
Fun.
Fun, not too fun.
We all need that support when we feel like a foreigner. Hey, why not click on the links in the show notes and support this foreigner? I appreciate it. Let's go back.
So that feeling of a stranger in a strange land, even though you had the same language, it was, if I may say it this way, you were in schemas that were known to you, but yet not known to you. Mm-hmm. They were familiar, but
deceptively familiar.
Yeah. Sometimes that can apply to interpreting.
Yes.
Sometimes we are in a setting which is familiar and we think we know how it will go, but then we realize, oh, I'm deceiving myself. How do we handle that? Do we act the same way that you and I did at the beginning, kind of holding back and being too polite and not actually making a decision or reacting?
Yes, I think there's a couple things that come to my mind when you bring up that topic. First of all, I think that interpreters sometimes are more certain and not enough curious. Mm-hmm. I think that because we go into so many unique settings, we have to assess and make determinations about people and dynamics and context so quickly that we become a little bit lazy in making more global, certain decisions about things, about people, about context. And then we're surprised when they don't fit. You know, we start interacting with those individuals and then all of a sudden we get a response we didn't expect, right? And then we're put on the back foot by that. So I think we do have to certainly be good. It's almost a bit of a delicate dance or a marriage between being good at assessing and understanding and making assumptions about what's going on or informed decisions about what's going on. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, being ready for or curious to things that might indicate there's something different than what we thought. So I think that that's very similar, is that I was put on the back foot pretty quickly when I started realizing things are not as I expect them to be or thought they would be, or harder than I imagined they would be in certain instances. And instead of being curious, I sort of just was afraid is too strong of a word, but timid. and tentative and, okay, I guess I won't go to that event because I'm not exactly sure if the bus 26 connects to bus 42 on the, you know, and so I would just sort of hold back. And so I think that that's the danger, is that if you are put on the back foot by a context, then the decisions that follow become more conservative, not because it's the right decision or a fitting decision, but because we are in that, we're not bouncing back, right? Brené Brown talks about this idea of resilience, or, you know, shame resilience. Like if we have a misstep or something we recognize is going on that we didn't expect to happen, that instead of addressing it in a more direct and resilient way, we kind of just, you know, step back and then opt to do nothing. Not because do nothing is the right decision, but because we're still dealing with our own, what we would call intrapersonal demands around making the misstep to begin with. So yeah, I think that there were times, again, for drawing a parallel between the move to the UK and what happens in interpreting assignments, I think that we have to recognize when we're choosing to not do something, and why am I choosing to not take this particular action, or I'm not moving forward? Mm-hmm. Is it because I really think that that's the best decision based on this new information I have? Or is it because I'm making it out of fear of retribution, or making another misstep, or even just sort of out of spite by giving up? Okay, fine. Then I just won't, you know, I just won't do this, you know? So I think that, yeah, there's certainly some learning from that.
Yeah. Back to your point of saying interpreters are
certain, but not curious.
Yeah. Interpreters sometimes are more certain and not curious. Does that connect back to your early years as an interpreter, where you kind of got used to the same people, the same settings, and you started feeling that burnout or, less excitement,
boredom almost. Yeah. Right. And I think that probably came as out of a sense of certitude, right? I didn't have a good lens with which to go very deep with what was happening at a dynamic level or a communication level, right? And that's why studying theory is so fascinating. Like if you study discourse analysis, right? Then you might be able to then listen to the discourse and see and point out certain things, which will give you that energy and that curiosity. Mm-hmm. So I think being curious, as opposed to feeling, you know, certain, being curious usually doesn't come just because you snap your fingers and hope that you become curious, right? You become curious because you have some device with which to investigate. And again, for those few years that I was trying different types of settings and eventually becoming, again, bored is too strong of a word, but certainly overly familiar with these contexts, because I didn't have a device or I didn't search for a device to look at these settings in a whole different way, or look at individuals in a whole different way. Then I quickly went from excitement to, okay, what's next? What's the next thing I want to do? Is it legal interpreting? Because I've tried medical, I've tried mental health, I've tried educational. And so instead of just going to the newness of the different setting, I needed newness to come from depth and the depth of looking at basically the human condition and human communication, which is endlessly fascinating. I mean, if you think about it, what are the television dramas that we spend hours binge watching, you know, on television, you know, cop shows, medical hospital shows, lawyer shows, all of these are about basically the human condition. And as interpreters, we have a front row seat to those very human dramas that are playing out every day in our work. And yet we are bored, or some of us become sort of bored, or we become overly familiar, or we go, yeah, I get it. But then we rush home to watch the television. It's the same thing. It's just, if you've got the device with which to see that and be curious about what's happening, the professional distance like you have between you and the television, if you can find that distancing effect, the witness, as you might say in the field, or the within Buddhism, or the observer mind, as you might see in, again, sort of meditative type teachings. If you can get the witness and the observer mind to see the work in front of you, then the human drama and the human condition will continue to be endlessly fascinating.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I try to teach interpreters within, you know, reflective practice is how can you use devices such as theoretical frameworks and constructs to build in that distance, not so you become cold and disconnected, but that you begin to get a separation that allows, instead of your emotions to get sort of caught, to get, you know, too overly involved in the situation, that you can kind of see it through the eyes of an observer. And not only does that allow you to have a better, more fruitful practice and be more effective as a practitioner, but it's just emotionally more sustainable and restorative, which is often lacking in professional development. Where are the opportunities for a restorative component to our professional development? We've got formative stuff. We've got tons of information, smart people saying smart stuff to us all the time, which is great. But to what degree does that information transform into content that restores us to go back out and do the work that we need to do to find that curiosity and that fascination?
We look to have more workshops that are not familiar to us. Perhaps that's what we need, are more workshops to give us more filters or maybe new lenses that we haven't seen before. New terminology, new ways to talk about it even.
One of the changes I'm trying to make in my own work as a thought leader, for lack of a better term, is the distinction between professional development and practitioner development. And what I say is that practitioner development is what sits at the intersection of professional development and personal development. Much, as I mentioned, Brené Brown in Shame Resilience, much of what makes us better at our work, given that interpreting is a practice profession, and I'll define that for those who may not be familiar with that term. Because interpreting is a practice profession and it involves the human condition and the human drama that we're all sort of stuck in, we need to work on ourselves and develop in a personal way that we then apply to our practice. So let me give an example, and then I'll define what I mean by practice profession. So this is going back to being overly familiar, right? Or feeling competent within a context. I was interpreting for someone who was getting a cortisone shot in their knee, in a joint to help with, you know, arthritis or injury, et cetera. And I don't care for needles myself. And so I was quite happy when the appointment was over because seeing people in pain and also imagining my own pain experience with being, you know, with large needles is quite unpleasant. But as we were walking out from the exam room to check out at the reception desk, the deaf woman looked at me and said, and she said it to me, not so much to the receptionist. She sort of said it to me. She said, "I feel dizzy." And I immediately reacted by saying, "Oh, yeah, that's, I get that way too. I get anxious. It's probably anxiety and stress." Like I started to use, I saw her experience as my experience, not as an experience separate from me, which is, again, a very human thing to do. There's a very famous saying, and I've used this in the textbook. We do not see things as they are. We see things as we are, right? And so when she said, "I feel dizzy," my experience was, "Yeah, I know. Thank God that's over. I can't wait to, you know, have a seat and drink some water and, you know, get over the stress and the emotion of it all." And so I caught myself as I was sort of assuring her everything was fine and thought, "Oh my goodness, that's me," right?
Yeah.
So I quickly shifted from that reaction to assure her to say to the receptionist, "Is there a nurse around? She said she's feeling dizzy," right? And immediately the receptionist responded by saying, "There's a seat over there. A nurse overheard us and came over and everything worked out just fine." But that's a simple example of if we don't engage in that know thyself directive of being a human being, then when you go into your work, you're going to carry too much of your own baggage and issues and the ways in which you see the world. Now, there's no way to be objective, but an author by the name of Smith called it disciplined subjectivity. So we're all very subjective in how we see things and understand things. We can't get out of our own brains, but we can be disciplined in our subjectivity. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, I was lucky enough in that moment to stop myself and say, you're actually it's not about you and your anxieties about getting a big needle in your joint, yeah. Right? So that goes back to this idea of if we can engage in practitioner development, where it's that intersection between those things that help us understand the people, ourselves, the human condition, and how they apply to the everyday human drama that, as I said, we get a front seat to. And that's an expectation of all practice professions. So in our work, very early on, probably in that 2003 publication that I mentioned, we define this idea that interpreting is a practice profession, a practice-based profession. And a practice profession is distinguished from technical professions. We tend to think of ourselves as technical professionals because what do? We work between two languages, two cultures, mm-hmm. and all we do is sort of, you know, engage in the task of message transfer. So that's work very technical minded. But because we work in contexts, because we work with varying variety of individuals and people and the ways in which they see and understand the world, our technical skills and abilities have to be augmented and enveloped in interpersonal skills and the ability to connect and develop rapport and trust, just like every other practice profession, such as lawyers and teachers and social workers, doctors, nurses, etc. So all the practice professions have to have good technical skills, mm-hmm. right? For us, it would be, for me specifically, ASL and English, and cultural understandings and knowledge and context, right? Medical settings, et cetera. So all those are my technical skills, but they're only effective within a relationship between deaf people and hearing people and myself. Mm-hmm. And so that's the interpersonal element that all practice professions deal with. Mm-hmm. And as such, the need to understand and know thyself is vital to being effective. Otherwise, if the relationship is where good, effective practice happens, that if you don't have, if you've got emotional needs that you don't get met and therefore use your work to get your emotional needs met, that's a problem for effective practice. And that would be true for any practice professional, mm-hmm. That they really do have to learn to separate their own personal needs from the needs that are from the needs of the individuals that they serve. And so that's kind of where I'm trying to move my work as a trainer, educator, is on this idea of practitioner development versus professional development in a more sort of strict sense of that word.
Mm-hmm. Let me summarize a few points from today's episode. It's not a surprise that many people misunderstood demand control schema when it first came out. It was a wonderful way of looking at how we do our work, the things that influence us in the situation, and what we try to do to manage all of those things while we are working on the interpreting process. We can immediately start jumping to conclusions about how this works, but it's not until Robin and Robert fleshed out all of the details of how this applies to our profession, and we then knew what it truly means. That's a lesson we can all bear in mind when something new comes to our eyes and we see it for the first time. It may make clear sense to us from our perspective, but we must remember to always ask and always analyze and challenge ourselves about our understanding, because it's similar to the way we develop as an interpreter. We become familiar with all of the settings that we work in, similar people, similar language use. We think we know more than we really do, and we forget about the challenges
that we go through in every situation. The last point that Robin hits on is about sign language interpreting being a practice profession. It means we are always developing. We must always reflect on what we do in every context. When we become familiar, we can become complacent, we can become bored, and we can become burned out. That's where ongoing development continues to challenge us. We should go to a workshop with the goal of challenging ourselves rather than asking the workshop to challenge us. When we go with that mindset, we are open to seeing new things and old things in new ways. As we encounter negative or positive influences or happenings in our work, take all of those as challenges. How do I apply this to my work to improve myself, to improve my interpreting process, to improve our profession? Then we will start truly reflecting on our work as we are open to challenges. Next week, we continue the conversation with Dr. Robin K. Dean. Until then, keep calm. Keep interpreting every challenge. I'll see you next week. Take care now.